Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In 2004, Americans were shocked by allegations that American soldiers had abused Iraqi prisoners at a place called Abu Ghraib. As a result, the U.S. Department of Defense removed 17 soldiers and officers from duty, and 7 were charged with dereliction of duty, maltreatment, aggravated assault, and battery. They were tried, found guilty, and sent to federal prison. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll talk with journalist Philip Gurevich about his new book, Standard Operating Procedure. The book draws on interviews with soldiers who served at Abu Ghraib. And Gurevich says that it would be easy for us to dismiss them as unaccountable villains and as rogues and as perverts. However, he says when you listen to what they have to say, as they talk about their experiences, they emerge as patriotic, as young, as inexperienced, people who were expected to implement practices that struck them as bizarre, even un-American, and yet they did it because that's what they were told to do. Our guest, Philip Gurevich, is the editor of the Paris Review, a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker, and is also author of a book about the Rwandan genocide. The title of that book is We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed with Our Families. That book won many prizes, including the National Book Critics Circle Award, the L.A. Times Book Prize, and the George K. Polk Award for Foreign Reporting. The new book, Standard Operating Procedure, is recently out. It's published by Penguin Press. You can certainly find it in the bookstore. Questions, as we talk, are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, so if you're listening on the air around Illinois and Indiana or across the country on the Internet, use the toll-free line and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. So once again, in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Gurevich, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, nice to talk to you.
Just to start here, I'd like to have you talk a little bit about how it is that this book came about and how it is that you came to the material that you used to write the book.
The book is a collaboration with the filmmaker Errol Morris, who was making a movie of the same title. And I'd known him for some years. And in the summer of 2006, he started getting in touch with me with and sending me transcripts of the interviews he'd started conducting by then with soldiers who had served at Abu Ghraib, many, including some of those who had appeared in or taken the now iconic photographs of abuse and torture there. And he sent them to me, and I was reading them and finding them utterly fascinating, and he said, you know, there are quite a lot of material here, and at that point already I noticed that he had about 1.5 million words of transcript. He had over 100 hours of interviews. You know how long a movie is. It's about 2 hours. And he said, there's a lot more than I'm going to be able to fit into a movie. What about a book? And we decided that what we would do is something that, as far as I know, and we've talked about it, it hasn't been done elsewhere, which is to not make a book of the movie or the movie of the book, but simultaneously, while each thing was in progress, he would make his movie. I would write a book drawing on this material and anything else. They would be closely related because they drew from the same extraordinary archive of the interviews he created. And what immediately drew me to this material was that I had felt for a long time that it had been very difficult to get at the story of the Iraq War and of the new policies that had followed September 11th and the war on terror, simply from the way that we were mostly hearing about them, which is the top-down, the description of torture memos and of policy maneuvering, and much of that was seen as kind of partisan and as very closely related to Washington. What was interesting was to see policy manifest in the lives of young men and women who had gone to serve the country in combat. That's what I suddenly heard the voice of, and hearing it in the voice of these people in their very specific individual experience, which is not the same even one to the next, I suddenly saw the contours of what one might call a classic war story, a war story where you see the history of a time reflected in the experience of the ordinary soldier, in this case the soldier who had been scapegoated to a large degree for policies that they had been instrumentalized to carry out, And it became very, very striking image and sense, drama of where we are. Hmm.
Before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, what significance did Abu Ghraib have for the people of Iraq?
Abu Ghraib was, in many ways, the symbol of the Saddam gulag. It was the, for lack of a better word, the flagship prison of his penal colony, which was one of the main instruments of control and repression that he had. It was at Abu Ghraib that Saddam had his big death house and torture chambers, and it was a prison that was famous for hundreds of executions a week. It was where people disappeared in a obviously essentially a Stalinist kind of prison system. There were many other prisons, secret and not so secret, around the country, but Abu Ghraib was massive. It was 260 acres within the walls. There were basically four or five separate prison compounds, like each one a separate prison within that larger compound, and those were run by different of his police services and different interior agencies. Then there was the death house and cremation area. There were bodies buried around the grounds. It was a place where people were disappeared. It was feared, it was ominous, and it was despised. And in the fall of 2002, in the run-up to the war, an extraordinary thing happened in Iraq, which is that Saddam liberated all the prisoners in the country, which seemed to some as evidence of him capitulating or making some kind of gesture of kowtowing to the threat of being invaded and thrown out of power by the American-led invasion. But in many ways, in fact, was him sowing chaos for that invasion. He maintained a kind of control by turning his prisoners into his insurgents. And as a result, the prison was standing empty when people came, but there were also large numbers of genuine criminals and of veterans of the system roving the countryside unaccounted for.
When the United States decided to use Abu Ghraib once again as a prison, was it conscious of this legacy, or did it simply think, well, here's a building, it was a prison, we might as well use this and make this a prison again?
Both. In fact, in the book, there's a character, a couple of men who were former corrections officers, the chief of the Department of Corrections in Utah, a man named Lane McCotter, and the man who had been his predecessor in Utah, Gary DeLand, who had been sent over in early May of 2003, right after the end of major combat was declared, by the Justice Department to do an assessment of the correctional system such as it was in Iraq and figure out what would be needed to create a modern, new, democratically run, proper, up-to-date prison system there. And no sooner did they arrive than they were told, listen, I know you were told you have 4 months to check things out and see what's needed, but actually we know what's needed. We need a prison up and running to deal with murderers and violent criminals immediately. And they started going around and looking, and they found, of course, that all these prisons that had been emptied the preceding fall had been gutted and looted and pillaged to their bare bones. And when they came upon Abu Ghraib, they didn't know the history of it. It was Lane McCotter who came there, but he said, look, this is the first time I've seen a prison. It was built on Western plans in the 60s. It even has, as he notes with some delight, Folger Adams locks on the doors, just like the prisons he'd run in Texas. And he said, you know, this was a regular, proper, actual prison structure that could be put into use and put online. And as he pushed for its renovation, he was, by the way, thinking of it as something for a civilian prison system, for a criminal justice system, not as a military prison. He got some resistance, increasing resistance, from people who said, wait a minute, that is a symbol of everything that's wrong with Saddam's regime. Do we really want to get into that? By then, the military was already using it as a detention center. And as the insurgency escalated, Sergio DeMello, the UN ambassador, came to look at it. Paul Wolfowitz, the deputy defense secretary from Washington, came and looked at it. And they finally said, look, let's do it. And they put it back online, in answer to your question, knowing what it had been symbolically and feeling that there was no choice. They needed it again.
And for those people who were assigned to work there, and particularly I'm thinking of the people who ended up being charged with crimes, the subject of when we think of Abu Ghraib, the people that we think about, mm-hmm. was any part of their training or preparation working in or training in how to be a prison guard?
No. There were a couple people in the people that we're talking about, the soldiers that we're talking about, belonged to the soldiers who took and appeared in the iconic and notorious photographs from Abu Ghraib were soldiers from the 372nd MP Company, a reserve company out of Cressop Town, Maryland. That company was not a company trained in detention operations. They were not trained to run prisoner of war camps or displaced person camps or to deal with detention in any form in their military service. Several of them had civilian corrections experience, but that would only have told them how to run a prison, work as a prison guard in the United States. And obviously, once they got to a prison that was situated, among other problems, almost more important than its symbolism, was that it was situated at the heart of the Sunni Triangle, which at that point was the heart of the insurgency. And so it was in a combat zone, which is, under all laws of war, not an allowed place for a prison. They had been basically a combat MP unit, which means that they loaned combat support to infantry and warfighters in the field. They did convoys. They had a lot of trucks. They did operations, including things like kicking down doors when you're searching for people. They did all sorts of police training. But actually working as what's known as an internment and resettlement operations MP, they had no training in it.
Mm-hmm. So when they
were assigned to something they shouldn't have been doing.
Well, when they got there and they were being in it, someone then when they got there said, okay, here's the job, here's what you need to do, here's how you're going to do it, here's how you're going to relate to the prisoners. Someone had to give them the instructions on doing the job that they were expected to do. Who did that?
When they arrived at Abu Ghraib, they arrived at Abu Ghraib in the first weeks of October 2003. By then, the prison had been running in various in a steadily increasing capacity since really June, certainly, and really late May, so for several months. Who was in place at the prison at that time was another MP company out of Nevada. And for the most part, the training that the 372nd received was on-the-job training, so-called, of a day or two riding along, they call it. They call it left seat, right seat, meaning the person whose job it is in the driver's seat, you're in the passenger seat, basically shadowing them, see what they do, and then later on, monkey see, monkey do. That's the training. There was no systematic training in Geneva Conventions. There was no standard operating procedure. Now, the term standard operating procedure is used in many contexts in the military, but one context, importantly, is it means the published set of rules for how you would run a facility. And, for instance, at Guantanamo Bay, the published book of a standard operating procedure for military policemen is 137 pages long. It deals with everything from how to feed them, to getting them a haircut, to burying them according to a Muslim funeral if they die, to conducting them down a hallway, how to walk through a door with a prisoner. Everything is regulated. There was nothing for that. And what they were told is for those who were going to serve on the specific block of the prison which held the high-value detainees, the block that was controlled by military intelligence for prisoners basically during and pending interrogation, they were told these are the worst of the worst, and in here military intelligence sets the terms. And when they walked in, they found prisoners naked. They found prisoners hooded with panties. They found prisoners chained to the doors of their cells in painful stress positions. And they said, wait a minute, what's this? And they were told, this is the way it's done here. This is what MI wants. That was very consistent, and it's consistent that they also, and it's important when we think about how the story played out, that these conditions actually preexisted their arrival.
Yeah, that they didn't, they may indeed have committed prisoner abuse, but a lot of these things were in place when they got there.
Yeah, and there's an interrogator who said to us, you know, look, when you look at the history of the war on terror, you first had people arriving in Afghanistan, there's this steady erosion of practices. So the first place you go, they say, well, you know, you can take the gloves off a little. And so things end up where you have naked prisoners. Then the next group comes, naked is normal. And they're told, you know, we're taking the gloves off a little. So they go from there to the next step. Well, by three or four rotations in, you're into some pretty nasty practices being standard and being what you find when you get there.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Philip Gurevich. He is an editor of the Paris Review, longtime staff writer for The New Yorker, and he's the author of a new book, Standard Operating Procedure. It's published by the Penguin Press, and it's something of a collaboration between him and documentary filmmaker Errol Morris, who conducted interviews with some of the soldiers that served in Abu Ghraib to make a documentary, and ended up with so much material he felt that more use could be made of it, and passed on some of the transcripts of the interviews to our guest. And he looked at it and said, yes, there's good material here, and decided to write a book that would be, in a sense, a companion to, but different from the movie, the documentary that Errol Morris ended up making. Questions are welcome. Here in this hour of Focus 580, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. What seemed to be a little bit confusing to me, and maybe indeed was confusing to the soldiers there, was the status of the prisoners at Abu Ghraib. And it seemed that the United States had to start out by trying to decide who these people were. Were they, in fact, civilians who committed civilian crimes and were simply criminals? Were they soldiers and therefore prisoners of war and subject to the Geneva Convention? Were they insurgents and the kind of person that no doubt the U.S. government would have labeled a terrorist? What were they, any of these things? Were they some combination of these things? And then, having made that decision, how do you decide what sort of rules that you're going to develop and apply to their treatment?
Very good question. Those three categories are the three categories that one would presumably start out with. And as I mentioned, there was an attempt going on to create and support the sort of reconstruction or the construction of a new criminal justice system to deal with everybody from, you know, a shoplifter to a murderer who wasn't involved in a military capacity in the country. There were also, in the run-up, a very important thing to understand is, after September 11th, the lawyers of the Bush administration spent a lot of time trying to figure out how and where the laws of war applied to them, and specifically what they'd be allowed to do if they wanted to go to considerable extremes in the application of force in interrogations. And that meant examining the definitions of torture in international law, and it meant examining particularly the Geneva Conventions, which are the core document of American military doctrine as it pertains to treating captives during wartime. And they made the president made a decision during the Afghan war that the Geneva Conventions would not be applied to the entire Afghan theater because, he said, Geneva's status really only applies to the soldiers of a foreign government, and these are all illegal fighters. They're either Taliban, which we're not going to recognize, or they're Al-Qaeda, and so we're going to call them illegal enemy combatants. And that meant that we could treat them with a much greater license than had ever been done before, and it had, as we know, there was a great deal of torture, and there was a good number of prisoner deaths in Afghanistan. When it came to Iraq, obviously we were fighting Saddam Hussein, who was a sovereign, and he had a sovereign army that ran as a national army. And so we were taking prisoners of war during the invasion. On May 1, when the president went aboard the aircraft carrier and made the famous mission accomplished speech and declared that major combat was over, he got a lot of razzing for that subsequently from the press and political critics because it was seen as presumptuous and triumphalist and premature, and obviously the mission hadn't been accomplished. But the speech is really interesting to revisit because if you go in there, what he really does is he ends up pivoting in that speech and saying, this is really just a chapter in the war on terror. Yes, we took out the tyrant. He doesn't even call him by name, and nor does he really mention that he's still at large, Saddam Hussein, and fighting. But this is really about the war on terror. And at that moment, he basically, by declaring the end of major combat, creates a shift in the legal paradigm that covers Iraq. And they start releasing the prisoners of war who were captured as Saddam soldiers. And at the same time, as they start arresting new people who are fighting them, they call them insurgents or terrorists, and they classify them as security detainees, people who might have intelligence value and whom they deem, because of a little loophole in the Geneva Conventions, can be held without any particular protections, indefinitely and without charges. With time, and by the time that our MPs in question arrive at the prison in the fall of 2003, the distinction between civilian and military has almost completely vanished because the only arresting authorities and the only real authority and the only power in the country is in the military. It's a military occupation. So even if you're just a shoplifter, you get handed over to the military most of the time. Or if you're picked up by an Iraqi cop, by the time you're in jail, you're in a military prison. There's no place to keep them separate, and they start getting lumped in together. At the same time, the U.S. military, particularly in the area around Abu Ghraib, the 4th Infantry Division, is conducting extensive sweeps, and they'll be sent out with a global positioning system coordinate and told, this house is where there's a suspected terrorist, and they'll simply sweep up all the men over the age of 13 or 15 in that area at the time that they pull up. And they're bringing in hundreds of people on trucks every day, every week, and the prison population is multiplying. These people are all tagged security detainee, so that their status is, to answer your question, very vague, not necessarily something with any really clearly defined standing in law, not something we have previous policies to cover. And those security detainees are being treated according to these new rules that are being put out by General Sanchez, the commander in Iraq, his lawyers, which say that for those who go to interrogation, all sorts of things can be allowed that have never been allowed before. The use of dogs, the use of environmental manipulation, sleep deprivation, stress positions, all of the things that we've seen in the photographs and that have been reported on since were being permitted for the first time there.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. I want to also invite others. He, again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller in Champaign, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hi. This is very interesting. I served during the first Gulf War, and, I was vaguely familiar with, or I wouldn't even say familiar, but I've heard of the Geneva Conventions. Hadn't even heard of the Hague Conventions Act. But I was very much aware of, what constituted, morality in terms of treatment of people. Conversely, my comrades, I have many comrades who enjoyed mistreating, certain individuals. But my question is, how much of this, in terms of what the soldiers did, plays along the lines of morality? Because what it sounds as if you're saying, and correct me if I'm just misconstruing this, is that it's very similar to the Nuremberg trials when people were saying, I was just following orders. And if the U.S. soldiers were, in fact, simply following orders, then, this is very problematic. Because there's the military trains you to be moral and a representative of the highest standards of the United States government. If you could comment on that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
It's an excellent question, and it's extremely pertinent because it gets at the question of what it means to follow orders. The Nuremberg precedent is that just following orders is not a sufficient excuse, and at the same time, that's what soldiers are trained to do. They're told not to follow illegal orders. But if, in the case of the Abu Ghraib soldiers, there's considerable indication that they repeatedly went to at least their immediate superiors, and their immediate superiors said, well, look, on that block, that's what MI wants you to do. They were taking pictures. These pictures were seen around the prison. And to some extent, the pictures were taken because the soldiers were shocked or surprised or saying, gee whiz, check this out. This is what they want us to do here. This is what we're allowed to do. Sabrina Harmon, one of the photographers who was at the prison, who took many of the pictures, who was herself training to be a forensic photographer, that was her ambition, she said when asked, why did you start taking pictures? Over and over she said, I wanted to record what was allowed. She used that word, was allowed. Charles Grainer, who's often depicted as the ringleader, as it were, but was merely the NCO in charge of the night shift, which is when most of the pictures were taken. He took a lot of pictures, and he kept talking about proof. He wanted proof, and he felt, this may sound bizarre to people who think, why would you take pictures that are self-incriminating? He felt that the pictures were his best hope of showing that this was, in fact, what was expected of them, and that they would have some hope of explaining what they were doing there. So if you have a climate where, on the one hand, you're told not to obey an illegal order, but every indication is that this order is not illegal or is intended, or that you're in some kind of a gray zone and there's no exit, and you are at the very bottom of the pyramid, that's where you get to the question of command responsibility and whether any of this could have possibly happened without commanders actually approving it. And what's striking is, at Abu Ghraib, there were medics present a great deal of the time. There were JAG lawyers, members of the attorneys of the judiciary wing of the military who were there and checking a lot of this out. There were JAG lawyers who had helped write the rules of interrogation. The International Committee of the Red Cross, whose job it is to monitor the Geneva Convention's application, sent delegations to Abu Ghraib, visited the site in question, and were stonewalled by the commanders at the prison, complained, wrote a report, said that the prison was in clear violation of the Geneva Convention, described nudity, prisoners held in darkness and stress positions with manacle scars on their wrists. This was essentially denied and rebuffed by the command in Iraq. Where is a reserve specialist, not even trained for the job he's put in, at an understaffed, undermanned prison, under attack, and at the end of the supply chain, supposed to turn? That's the trouble. It's not to simply make excuses for them, but to say, yes, they made excuses for themselves, but those excuses actually point to the juncture of a policy that was overturning our highest values in the name of fighting this war.
Clearly, the story wouldn't have as much impact as it did without the pictures. Some of the pictures make it look like the soldiers that are participating in this abuse of prisoners, it looks like they think this is a joke or a lark, or it certainly doesn't look like they're interested in documenting something terrible so that later they can say, look at how terrible it was. It's hard to look at some of them and not think that that somehow the soldiers that were participating were not taking this terribly seriously, and in fact that it almost seemed like they thought it was a joke.
That's right. Well, one of the problems is that in some of the pictures, the soldiers, I mean, there are several categories of photographs, and I think it's interesting to actually look at the way that the photograph taking evolved, because when you start at the prison, you get some of the most powerful photographs of the whole period, which are the photographs that were taken at the beginning, are entirely of prisoners without soldiers in the frame. They have a much more photojournalistic quality, as if a soldier was walking down a hallway, suddenly saw a prisoner chained to his cell or left on his bed, or hooded and shackled and naked with panties on his head or standing in a puddle, and simply took a snapshot. Look at that. My goodness. And those pictures are haunting and terribly lonely and terribly sad, and they are of what the conditions that these soldiers found when they appeared at the prison. There's no gloating. There's no judgment at all. They're strangely affectless. Strikingly, those photographs have never been the basis of any criminal complaints at all. Those are the photographs that, to a large extent, criminal investigators treated as evidence of standard operating procedures at the prison. The prison photographs that shocked us from Abu Ghraib are always ones in which there is a soldier present, and those are the ones that were prosecuted because, well, there you have it. The soldier's in the picture. They're guilty. Some of those pictures are not posed, and some of them are posed. And what you had was a group of soldiers who had previously, over the course of the war and their time together, had the habit of taking what they called happy snaps, pictures of themselves goofing around. And often, sometimes there'd be sexual horseplay mixed in with that, with they'd be mooning each other or flashing each other or mugging with each other in various ways. Over time, these two things started to get mixed together. In several of the famous incidents, most of all the famous incident of the naked pyramid of prisoners who were stacked together and in front of which people posed. And during the making of that pyramid, several of the female soldiers were coaxed into standing for the camera and pointing at the naked prisoners and seeming to jeer at them. I think we should be very, very careful to assume that, A, every time somebody's grinning at a camera, they're actually having fun, or that every time that they're goofing around with each other, they're not also goofing around as some form of distancing, rather than as evidence that they're simply getting off on it. It certainly shows some kind of poor judgment and juvenile behavior, and it's not attractive, and it's not really defensible. I'm not trying to defend it. I think that I'm trying to indicate that there's a level on which it has proved a massive national distraction. The fact that soldiers appear to be smiling and having pleasure made it very easy to say, these are simply depraved people. And if they had been going grimly about their chore, perhaps we would be more able to see it as a chore. There's nobody grinning or smiling in the photographs that I find some of the most appalling, which are the photographs of dogs being sicked on naked prisoners and even biting and tearing their flesh. You see soldiers in those photographs. And those photographs, oddly, were not prosecuted until much later. It was the photographs of people behaving in an unseemly fashion, because those were the most easy to say, these are rogues, these are out of line, and to frame the whole thing as a matter of the exception of soldiers who were aberrant and perverse, rather than as soldiers who were following what were, broadly speaking, the rules.
We're a bit past our midpoint here. We're talking this morning with Philip Gurevich. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. He is the author of a book about the Rwandan genocide. We wish to inform you that Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, a book that won the National Book Critics Circle Award and the LA Times Book Prize and the George Polk Award for Foreign Reporting. He is also now the author of a newly published book that draws on interviews with soldiers who served at Abu Ghraib. The title of the book is Standard Operating Procedure. It's published by the Penguin Press. It's out now. It's a kind of a collaboration with the documentary filmmaker Errol Morris, who did interviews, on-camera interviews with some of these soldiers, and then the transcripts, much more material than he could put in his documentary, he passed on to Philip Gurevich, and then he took those, with also some work and reporting, obviously, of his own, made it into a book, Standard Operating Procedure, and you can certainly find it now in the bookstore at the library. Questions, too, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I expect that one of the pictures that people will remember and that stays with them is the picture of a female soldier who is holding on to what appears to be, you only have to describe it as a leash that is attached to a leather collar that's around the neck of a naked man who was lying on the floor. This is a young woman named Lindy England. She was one of the people that talked with Errol Morris, and she is here in this book. How does she think about that picture and that event and this whole business? I mean, what is, you know, when she looks at that picture of herself, what does she see? What does she think?
She says, well, what I see is, yeah, that was a picture taken at the prison, and that's me at that time. And she says, I know that what everybody else sees is an icon of American perfidy, and me, a little American woman, she stresses that she's small American female, towering over a naked, prone Iraqi in bondage at the end of a leash, and that it's an image of humiliation and domination, and that it's come to be seen as a kind of icon of all that went wrong there. But it's extremely interesting to me when one investigates that story to find out what the account is that all the soldiers give that is entirely consistent. Charles Grainer gave an identical account to Army investigators when he was after he was sentenced for his role in this. He was sentenced, among other things, to cooperate with Army investigators and gave a very, very lengthy interview on the grounds that he had immunity from further self-incrimination. And I can tell you that he was quite open about many times where he was very, very abusive and violent with prisoners. And in this instance, he says, look, what happened was this was a new prisoner who'd been brought in threatening to kill Americans, shouting and spitting, and thrown in an isolation cell called The Hole, a dark, windowless cell with no fixtures or features, where he'd spent the day in his own filth, lying naked on the floor, and I was told that I had to get him out of there, clean up the cell, so that I could put somebody else in there. And I didn't have anybody else to help me. And I was trying to figure out how would I get him out of there, because I didn't really want to get into a fight with somebody. I didn't know who he was in the cell. And I saw this. I took a tie-down strap. It's not a dog leash. Nobody thinks it's a dog leash who was there. A tie-down strap that you'd use to strap cargo, say, to a Humvee. And I took the two women who were working that day with me as backup. And I also took my camera. And he said, I took my camera because he worked for the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. And he said, there, whenever we had a planned use of force and there was a possibility that anything could go wrong, we took video cameras so that if anything did go wrong, we'd have a record. So he goes down, he makes a loop with this thing, and he puts it around the prisoner's shoulders. The prisoner then starts to crawl, and it slides up to his neck. And as he comes out of the cell, Grainer hands the leash to Lindy England and takes three snapshots in 3 seconds, one of which becomes the iconic picture. She's simply holding it. The Army investigator who was in charge of investigating all of the photographs and on whose evidence many of the prosecutions took place, a man named Brent Pack, who's also one of the Errol Morris interviews that's at the core of this story, He points out that if you look at this photograph closely, although she's always described as dragging a naked prisoner, there is no tension on the leash. And interestingly, these photographs, Lindy England tells exactly the same story, as does Megan Ambule, a third MP who was there that night. And interestingly, Grainer then took these photographs and showed them to medics at the prison, saying, is this an okay thing to do in a situation like I was in, where we don't have the adequate means to get somebody out of a cell and you're extracting a prisoner who's potentially violent, and also who was, as it later seemed, to be mentally deranged on some level. He was not a cooperative prisoner, and he was often violent, at least in his rhetoric. He was, in fact, quite weak. And there were other prisoners who were mentally ill prisoners who were all thrown onto the same ward with these people. And the medic said, well, that looks like perfectly harmless to me. So one of the things that struck me about that story is here on the one hand, you had a ward, a prison block, where you had a policy of prisoner abuse. And then you had photographs which recorded that abuse. And then you had photographs which became iconic, but some of those photographs recorded something that was not abuse, that was not attractive, but that was certainly not what it appears to be. And it reminds one that one needs, what a photograph is it's a piece of evidence. It invites you to look beyond it, look through it, to investigate further. It is neither true nor false, and it cannot tell a story entirely by itself, but it can be too easy for us to assume that we see the whole thing and that when we see it, we know what we're seeing.
You know, in all of the discussion about prisoner treatment, particularly in places like Guantanamo and elsewhere, and what kind of interrogation procedures are allowed, sometimes I think people who have been interrogators, who are in this position, have said something like, you know, the interrogator ends up, in a sense, sharing in the same conditions that the person who is being interrogated shares in. If their exposure to loud noises, if they're kept awake for long periods of time, if they're put in a place that's very cold or very hot, that the interrogators also are exposed to some of those same conditions. Now, you wouldn't want to say that there is an exact equivalence here, but I think obviously, the people are saying that being the interrogator, being the person on the other side of this relationship, is not easy.
Well, I would make a distinction here, just so you to be clear. The guards, the military policemen, were not interrogators. They were used as condition setters, help set the conditions for the interrogation. The interrogator does not actually interact with the prisoner except in the interrogation, but he directs the conditions in which the prisoner is held. He'll say, I want this prisoner treated really nicely because he's being cooperative. Give him cigarettes and nice meals. Yeah. That's very rare. More often he'll say, I want this or that form of duress or discomfort or stress. Now, there are ways to do that are not torture. There are ways to just, okay, nobody talks to him for 3 days. Makes him nervous. There are ways that you can project fear that are completely legitimate within interrogation. And then there's physical abuse. Interrogators almost always insist, at least when they get in front of interviewers, that force just doesn't work. That one of the things that you have, there's an interrogator named Tim Dugan, who's in the book and in Errol Morris's movie, who said at one point, you know, on every interrogation report at the end, the last paragraph assesses your judgment of the validity of the information you've received in that interrogation. And if I've got it from him by force, I have no way to assume that it's valid. I have to assume it was given to me to make me stop hurting him. That's a pretty consistent view. There's no claim that valuable information was obtained at Abu Ghraib, which is pretty striking considering the amount of heat that those who went to these lengths have been under. But what you were saying about the identification, as it were, between the inflictor and the inflicted in these situations is striking, because the MPs, several of them, Javal Davis, Sabrina Harmon, they say, you know, I would talk to these prisoners and I would say, listen, we're in the same boat. We're prisoners here too. We're also trapped out here. We're also under fire. We're also being made to go through these things. We don't like any of it. Now, we all know whose position we'd rather be in, but it's striking that they felt completely like victimized on some level. And that may be making excuses or sound a little self-dramatizing, but they were instruments of something rather than simply free agents undertaking this for sport.
We have a caller here, someone calling on a cell phone from Sydney, not too far away, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
In the first newspaper accounts that I read about Abu Ghraib, there were references to non-uniformed government employees and the reference of agency given to their employment origin, as in CIA, but then those references dropped out of the newspaper accounts very shortly after that and were gradually replaced with the phrasing of rogue element or bad apple or whatever. So my question to you is, in the interviews that you had access to, did any of the Army Guard personnel refer to CIA personnel, setting the tone for softening up and other phrases contributing to or being directly responsible for the abuse?
Absolutely. Yes, that's actually an important part of the story is, as I said, this cell block where all of these pictures were taken, which was the so-called high-value detainee area, it was under the overall control of military intelligence as opposed to being run by the MPs themselves, by themselves. But military intelligence shared the space with a lot of people who, broadly speaking, were referred to as OGA, which means other government agencies, which is the pervasive euphemism for CIA. You might think it's odd that you need an acronym as a euphemism for another acronym, but that's how it is. Everybody uses that phrase. It didn't only mean CIA. It could also mean DIA. It could mean FBI. It could mean some of the special task forces that were tasked with manhunt operations in the country. But there were CIA operatives there, and one of the more famous and shocking photographs that came out of Abu Ghraib were the photographs that came to be known by the tabloid press as Iceman, the body of a dead Iraqi packed in ice bags. And in one of the photographs, Sabrina Harmon is seen smiling, giving the thumbs up. But she also took a series of photographs that are very forensic in nature when she saw this body, when the body, which was in a cell, being stored there. She went in and looked at it. She peeled back these bandages that had been put on it after it was killed and started photographing all of this to create really the most extensive evidence we have of what the Army itself classified as a homicide. And that was committed by a CIA agent, or the interrogation was done by a CIA agent during which this man died in what was classified as a homicide by the Army, never been prosecuted. His name was reported by Jane Mayer in The New Yorker subsequently. There were a lot of CIA agents in there, and the MPs kept a logbook, which we have, in which they wrote just a lot of housekeeping stuff about, you know, between shift changes and things, this guy's in this cell, this guy needs this, this guy got sick, that guy got found with a knife. And they refer always to the prisoners who were CIA as OGA, as I said, and there were as many as 10 out of 45 of the cells or so there at a given time. So that's quite a considerable presence.
Yeah, and were the Army personnel prohibited from discussing OCA in the interviews or in testimony?
Oh, no, that comes up in the government reports, but it just gets very vague. They didn't always know. I mean, there was this idea, oh, here's the CIA, they're the biggest, baddest game, and you don't ask a lot of questions. When they come through, they do what they do. The MPs were essentially there as a kind of, it sounds glib, but I don't mean it that way at all, almost as the wait staff, as the maintenance people. Their job was, if an interrogator came in and said, I have a prisoner in such and such a cell, I want the following conditions imposed when I'm not here, and now go get him and bring him to me for his interrogation in the shower or in an interrogation booth outside. They were the ones who were supposed to conduct that. They weren't supposed to setting the terms or inventing the terms. So they would say, yeah, there was an OGA guy. I don't know who he was. I don't know why he was there, but he was OGA. All of the military intelligence personnel, as well as the OGA, wore what they called sterile uniforms. They did not wear rank. They did not wear name tags. They often wore a mixture of civilian clothes, and mixed into this mix to complicate things further. Military intelligence is a relatively small community of interrogators, and as we know, since the end of the Cold War, and really for a long time in the late Cold War, there wasn't a lot of demand for combat operations with military intelligence components. And so it's a very small group of people who were suddenly called upon, and they started hiring a lot of civilian contractors as well from several private contracting firms. So mixed in were people who were folded into the hierarchy but weren't actually technically under military command, and some of whom actually had their contracts from the Interior Department, just to complicate it.
Okay, and then correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't recall seeing or hearing of any intelligence officers per se actually being tried. Am I correct or incorrect on that?
There were, in the later phases of the trials, two, it may have been a third, of the lowest-ranking military intelligence guys were sentenced for having appeared in photographs. They were sentenced for abusing prisoners, but it was for an incident in which one of them, literally what he was accused of, was splashing water on a naked prisoner. The reason he was prosecuted is that he appeared in photographs for an incident that some of the MPs had gotten in trouble for. But for any of the actual practices and for the overall structure, no. The overall prison, normally prisons are run by military police. The prison's overall command was placed in November of 2003 under the command of Colonel Pappas, the military intelligence chief at the prison. He was given a reprimand and docked a couple months' pay. His career, I suppose, was ended, but it certainly was very, very far from the sort of legal and bringing to justice of the lowest-ranking soldiers who were under his command.
I'd like to try to get at least one more caller in here. We have short on time, but let's try here. Line two is Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
A question. Are you familiar with the psychologist Philip Zimbardo's thesis in a book, I think, called The Lucifer Effect, claiming that he testified on behalf of the guards there, claiming that what they did was more due to the situation rather than to some intrinsic tendency to do evil.
I'll
hang up.
Yes, I am familiar with it, and I think that there's no question on some level that that's true, but he attributes everything to two things. That my difference with Zimbardo's view is that he attributes everything essentially to a kind of group psychology and environmental stimulus. The environment contributes to everything. And the fact is, individuals reacted differently. Even within this group, there are very different personal, intellectual, moral, and actual actions. Some were more enthusiastic, some were considerably less so, some were more observers, some were drawn along, and so forth. And the most important thing that I think that he overlooks, and I keep coming back to it because it's critical, because it is the part that endures as part of the legacy of this, is that this was not about the environment. This wasn't about what happens in war. This wasn't what happens when there's a breakdown in discipline merely. It's what happens when it's intended. This is policy. This was not something that happened because it wasn't supposed to, but somehow got out of hand. It was something that happened because it was supposed to. And the fact that there was a certain amount of disorder, chaos, and indiscipline there doesn't mean that there wasn't also an intention. And that intention would have been shut down had the military wished to. A working military would not have allowed sadism or enthusiasm or zeal in the abuse of prisoners to take place. It's happened now in all of these prisons where these rules were in effect, and in the aftermath, far from our having a sort of national debate about is this the image of ourselves and of our force that we want to project into the world, we've actually had a furthering of these policies and a cementing of them as the legacy of this period in our history, as something that we should continue to do and we should go forward with. And that's deeply troubling, because I think it is at odds with our traditions, with the image and the force that we've projected into the world and the way that we want to. And I think it places us all in greater danger. And that's something that I think can't be lost sight of when one looks at other explanations about psychology.
And in about 30 seconds, these folks who were charged with crimes and found guilty, did they feel that an injustice was done to them?
I think that the best way to put it is that they may reckon quite accurately that they were instruments of some considerable injustice at the prison, but that, yes, they were also ultimately scapegoated, and that if what they did was a crime and they should be punished for it, then that means a lot of people higher up should be punished for it and held to account as well. That if what they did was in fact worthy of the crimes, the punishments and the penalties and the criminal tags that they've got, then that means that they've been hung out to dry for something that they were part of rather than that they were alone in.
Our guest is Philip Gurevich. He's a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker. The book is Standard Operating Procedure. It's published by the Penguin Press. Mr. Gurevich, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.